Welcome back to Academic Agent Retrospective. This is part five. Now, despite my reputation as a staunch conservative, social conservative, that is, I have not actually talked about degeneracy that much, comparatively speaking, in the history of the channel. Just these 10 videos, really. And of those, some of them are kind of rank punditry, such as the story about CNN trying to normalize cuckolding or the bit of spot analysis on Nigel Farage versus Piers Morgan. However, over the course of these videos, you will see a kind of thesis develop. Also, it's a number of these videos here, especially What Causes Reactionary Revolutions and the two videos taken from the Stray Thoughts series, were hit with age restrictions on YouTube, as well as a kind of copyright block in the case of the What Causes Reactionary Revolutions one. So these are somewhat little seen videos, although I actually think they're of quite high quality. Then, of course, there is the Zoomers are Coomers, which set off a whole saga, of which I've only included the one that kicked it all off in this compilation. So, an important topic, degeneracy, sexual mores, if you want. Just before I let you watch it, I'll remind you again that if you use the code RETRO on the Academic Agency, that's the code RETRO, you can get £100 off any of the bundles that are being sold. And that's a little tie-in deal that I've got running all week here on the Academic Agent Retrospective. I hope you enjoy this one. Today, well-known purveyors of fake news and partisan deep state shills, CNN, ran this story. Now, obviously this is hilarious, but I want to pause to ask why they are running a story like this. What are they trying to do? It's clear that they are trying to normalize and mainstream cuckolding. Why? Now, back in 2015, in his hit series, Why Do People Hate Feminism, Sargon of Akkad, probably just as a joke, talked about active cuckolding being the final stage of feminism.
But the ultimate destination for the relationships of a feminist man is to become cuckolded in an open marriage. As I write this, my children are asleep in their room. Loretta Lynn is on the stereo and my wife is out on a date with a man named Paolo. It's her second date this week, her fourth this month so far, and if it goes like the others, she'll come home in the middle of the night, crawl into bed beside me and tell me about how she and Paolo had sex. I won't explode with anger or seethe with resentment. I'll tell her it's a hot story, and I'm glad she had fun. It's hot because she's excited, and I'm glad because I am a feminist. But it's not like it doesn't go both ways. He says, I too enjoy sexual carte blanche. I just don't use mine as much as my wife uses hers. Or possibly, you can't use yours as much as your wife can use hers. Feel free to refer back to the images of the Sahara Desert if it's not clear why that is. And this is because of feminism. Monogamy meant I controlled her sexual expression, and not to get all women's studies major about it, patriarchal oppression essentially boils down to a man's fear that a woman with sexual agency is a woman he can't control. Before my wife started sleeping with other men, I certainly considered myself a feminist, but I really only understood it in the abstract. When my wife told me she wanted to open our marriage and take other lovers, she wasn't rejecting me, she was embracing herself. When I understood that, I finally became a feminist.
Jealousy is actually kind of an interesting topic, because usually when we talk about jealousy, we're talking about somebody who has something that you don't. Like, if you're jealous of somebody who's got, like, a candy apple, you can't necessarily be jealous that they have a candy apple if they're sharing it with you.
Now, what was a satire and a joke in just 2 years has become reality, as America's new station of record openly promotes cuckoldry as something positive, complete with a woman, a bull, and a cuck pictured prominently in the story. Then now this is actually quite dark.
Radical leftists have always absolutely hated the idea of the traditional family unit, a mother and a father with children. Hence their decades-long assault on this idea, the idea of women as wives or as mothers, or the idea of a child having two parents as a social norm. Now, what really irritates me about this is that for their own lives, they'll live very conservatively, married with kids for the most part. But for the rest of society, they push a different message. Marriage is increasingly becoming the preserve of wealthy middle-class people, coincidentally also those who virtue signal most loudly about their progressive values. You know, the sort of people who tend to write for CNN, for example. And the people who suffer most from this, of course, are poor people. And in America, that means the black community. A while back, I remember reading a good piece on this in The Spectator. Let me share some of the key passages for you. There was no marriage gap between rich and poor a couple of generations ago, but one has been opening up. The Office for National Statistics divides Britain into seven social classes. According to a study prepared for The Spectator, someone in the top class, i.e. company directors, university lecturers, and so on, I like the fact that I'm in the top class apparently, is 48% more likely to be married than someone in the bottom social class, that is, builders, office cleaners. At the turn of the century, the gap was 22%. To those that think marriage is a quaint irrelevance, such figures don't matter. But if you think that marriage is the most powerful sponsor of health, wealth, and education, then it ought to be alarming. A new inequality is being bred in our society. Why? Figures for the proportion of children born outside marriage seldom rose above 5% from the Victorian era right to the 1960s. Then things started to change. By the time of Prince Charles and Lady Diana's wedding in 1981, it was 13%. Since then, it has almost quadrupled, and the decline of marriage has been far more pronounced in working-class areas than in genteel middle-class England. The Marriage Foundation recently discovered that 87% of mothers from higher income groups are married today, compared with just 24% of those at the other end of the social scale. And you can see this ably illustrated by this graph here. Marriage is in a very healthy shape for the upper middle class. Indeed, for all their progressive politics, the haute bourgeoisie are highly conservative in their behaviour. Even in the very liberal part of London where I live, 82% remain, few people live what Channel 4 used to call alternative lifestyles. Sure, most of the mothers go back to work after their children enter full-time education, but then the local schools also depend on volunteer parents, mostly mothers, to be the social glue holding everything together, just as their grannies did. As one of the other local dads said to me, observing the contradiction between how right-on people are in their politics and how traditional in their lives, I like it around here. It's sort of like the 1950s, isn't it? This is what the sociologist Charles Murray means when he asks that America's ruling class preach what they practice. That is, self-control, restraint, monogamy, and, if necessary, abstinence. These ideas are unfashionable precisely because the wealthier and better educated find them easier to live by. And you can find a parallel to this story in the USA. Here's some data from Pew that I found. Married adults, 55%, are more likely to identify themselves as middle class than are unmarried adults. This is true for each subgroup of unmarried adults, those who are living with a partner, separated, divorced or widowed, or never married. So, in the face of this alarming trend, how are news organizations like CNN reporting it? That's right, actively telling men that it's all right for their wives to go and fuck other men. I mean, what the hell? Now, I did try to Google to see if the BBC had ever run an article on this, but something of a schoolboy error. I'd like to thank Son of Tiamat, Cult of the Lich, Tyson Powell, Ginger Bill, Charles Vincent, Edward Darrah, Blake Barrows, and Nathan Pullum. Till next time.
Every so often I get a strong sex urge, and the only way I can take care of it is to masturbate.
The boy wants a girlfriend. And why has this remarkable change happened? Well, say it how you like, it all boils down to nature making sure that the human race is going to go on. You see, all those changes that have happened to their bodies add up to one great step forward. They're now capable of reproducing themselves, of becoming fathers and mothers of children following the process called sexual intercourse. It didn't take civilized man long to discover that the only workable way to use this remarkable power was for a man and a woman to pair off and to raise their children as a family. And whatever else we say here, we must recognize that our society accepts the married state as right and regards sexual intercourse outside marriage as irresponsible and possibly disastrous.
The vast majority of behavior problems in the classroom involve minor breaches of discipline. These incidents frequently originate in the classroom situation itself and are within the control of the teacher. Disciplinary problems in the classroom are symptoms of underlying weaknesses in total learning situations. Mr. Grimes, mathematics teacher, is displeased with the progress of his ninth grade class in mathematics.
You see what low grade you made on your weekly mathematics test? More than half of you failed. Most of those who passed just got by. Nobody had 100%. This is the poorest class I've had in a long, long time. Most of you have no foundation at all. Now the trouble's with your attitude. You don't pay enough attention in class. You don't do enough work outside of it. You don't know what the word study means. You haven't the slightest idea. Don't you realize that mathematics is an important subject? I tell you right now that unless you get over your lazy habits and come up to the standards I've set for this class, many of you will have the pleasure of repeating this course next semester.
We're here to say that we shouldn't even be stigmatized with the word welfare. For the rich, it's called subsidy. For the poor, welfare. When Mr. Pullman's railway or his boxcars, when he overextended himself and when he flunked, the government compensated or subsidized him. Because that subsidy didn't put Mr. Pullman on welfare. They subsidized. The state of Illinois, 90 cents out of every dollar on these highways come from Washington. The state of Illinois gives on welfare. The whole state is on welfare. People are unemployed today, not because they are lazy. People are unemployed, not because they don't want to work. Fact is, some of you gathered here have worked the hardest and the longest on the nastiest job. And the technology that we work to produce has rendered us economically useless. The only question left for leadership is, will today's unemployed group be seen as the success of America's economy?
Told that the way that you speak is improper English, or that the phonics is actually just broken English or garbage altogether. Well, I'm here to tell you that African American Vernacular English, or however the hell you want to refer to it, is just as valid as any other language and or dialect. What's up, my beautiful black babies, and welcome to another episode of Flash Noir. Now, in today's episode, we are going to be talking about African-American vernacular English and how basically because of white supremacy and racism and anti-blackness and everything rolled up into one, the way in which we speak is deemed as improper or broken English or considered to be outright garbage. What compelled me to actually make a video on this is because of racism and on top of that, ableism, those who use African American vernacular English are seen to be as uneducated, less intelligent, and just overall inferior or wrong. It is very ableist, one, to assume that because of the way in which someone speaks that they are somehow unintelligent and that is somehow reason enough to treat them badly or to, you know, dismiss what they have to say or not to take them seriously. That's very ableist. But it's very racist in regards to African American vernacular English, because this is not the only dialect and or language that this happens with, especially not with white people, because white supremacy. But
I think the tabloid press image of thousands and thousands of women, yes, just having babies for the sake of it to get benefits, mm, and to get housing and all that. There are some women like that, I will not deny it, but they are such a small, yep, minority who are repeatedly targeted by certain sections of the media.
Talk about with our friends. You ready, Teddy?
Ready, ready, ready.
Okay, today we are talking about gender expression.
Next question. What is 3 times 3? Yes?
9.
Wrong. Yes, Penelope.
Gender equality.
Very good, Penelope.
Is this a joke?
You think gender equality is a joke?
No, but isn't this a maths class?
Don't be so racist.
I just asked a question.
We don't ask questions. Questions are offensive.
Yeah!
Now, students, I trust you've all completed your research assignments.
I know you are proud of me. And that fills me with everlasting joy. And now, I want to get some perspective. If I may be so honored, to have all the female nominees in every category stand with me in this room tonight. The actors, Meryl, if you do it, everybody else will, come on. The filmmakers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the cinematographer, the composers, the songwriters, the designers. Come on. Ms. Voynet.
What, however, happened in the 80s, most likely as a result of the malign influence of Mary Whitehouse and her powerful lobby group, the Viewers and Listeners Association, was that the Conservatives ossified in their position on social values. The most notable of those stances was that on homosexuality. One of the key measures reflecting this position was Section 28. Section 28 of the Local Government Act 1988 prohibited local authorities from promoting homosexuality or gay pretended family relationships, and prevented councils spending money on educational materials and projects perceived to promote a gay lifestyle. This flew in the face of public attitude of the time. It was 1988. Boy George was in the charts, so too Depeche Mode, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Erasure and the Communards. The 1980s was possibly the gayest decade of the century, and here were the Tories retrenching on laws targeting homosexuality.
Stop.
One of the wonders of progressivism is how it has managed to rewrite history and the collective memory. The Britisher here calls the 1980s the gayest decade, but if we look at the British Social Attitude Survey for the 1980s, which is probably the most robust survey of its type in the world, we can see in 1983 at least half of the respondents thought that sexual relations between two adults is always wrong. This rose to 54% in 1984, 59% in 1985, and peaked at 64% in 1987. It remained at 50% or above in 1989, 1990, and 1993. In fact, the majority of the public would not agree that same-sex relationships between two adults were either rarely wrong or not wrong at all until 2010. Now, was this a normal, organic process, as Britisher suggests? He was very likely thinking of very visible cultural touchstones of the era thrust into the limelight by record label executives and television controllers. Or perhaps one thinks of the Pride movement, which was amplified by The Guardian and various other media outlets at the time. But as we can see, this was a vocal minority. The silent majority clearly agreed with Mary Whitehouse and indeed Margaret Thatcher, who made this speech in 1987.
But it's the plight of individual boys and girls which worries me most. Too often, our children don't get the education they need, the education they deserve. Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. All of those children are being cheated of a sound start in life. Yes, cheated.
As we can see from the data, only 13% of the country would have been against her explicitly on this point. And of course, Thatcher won that, her third election, rather convincingly. Thatcher passed Section 28, which explicitly prohibited schools and other government branches from explicitly promoting homosexuality. Now, how did we get from this point in 1987 to being where we are today, only 30 years later? Some clue can be seen in the legislation. Despite the continued majority public opinion on these issues, for some reason, MPs in the Houses of Parliament had been trying for years to reduce the age of consent for gay men. Indeed, they tried in 1994, only 7 years after Thatcher made that speech, with overwhelming public backing. In 1997, the European Parliament intervened in a British court case, Sutherland versus the United Kingdom, and ruled that it was discriminatory and therefore against human rights for the age of consent to be 16 for straight people and 18 for gay men. No matter how many times this was voted down by Parliament, it kept coming back, and finally, in 2001, they lowered the age of consent for gay men to 16. We're well into the Tony Blair era now, and of course in 2003 he passed discrimination laws making gay people a protected class with certain privileges. In effect, the positions put forward by Mary Whitehouse only two decades prior would now not have been allowed anywhere near television. It could be actively prosecuted. Indeed, Margaret Thatcher likely could not have given the speech that she did in 1987 in 2004 without provoking some sort of legal challenge. Now, if we go back to the data in 2003, this effectively criminalized the views of about 49% of the public. So I wonder if all of this is social and cultural change, or if it is what I describe as top-down social engineering, promoting the interests of a minority group above the stated preferences of the majority. The idea that any of this was inevitable is obviously not true. But the further claim that the Tories were too conservative on social issues, which made them out of step with a more socially liberal public, is obviously also bunk. if we lived in a country in which the media did not amplify certain voices above other voices, the outcomes may well have been different. And this is true regardless of where you actually stand on any particular social issue. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, The Crimson Satyr, The Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Vacherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyotomi Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darrow.
Can I just bring this back? I want to get serious for a moment. The Brexit Party is now a serious thing. It had a serious success in the European elections. One of your new Brexit Party MEPs is Anne Widdecombe. And she hit the headlines this week in a pretty unsavoury manner by suggesting that science may produce an answer to homosexuality. What is your reaction to what she said?
Well, science may provide all sorts of answers that you and I don't know about. Look, Anne Widdecombe is a devout Christian, and there is nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. She will have views on abortion and on homosexuality that'll be very different to the views that are held by many others. And you know something? I think these things are matters of conscience. I don't think they're matters for party leaders to support or condemn individuals because they have strong
views.
Hang on.
Stop.
So straight away, Nigel Farage has done something unusual. He's deviated from the normal script. He hasn't apologised. He's refused to condemn the remarks. He's given a fairly perfect, classical, liberal answer to the question. And immediately you can see that Piers Morgan is reeling. This wasn't in the script. This wasn't meant to happen. Let's carry on.
Well, hang on. That's a bit of a cop-out, isn't it? Because she's one of the most high-profile people representing your party. She has said something that many gay people in this country, I would think almost every gay person
suggesting
in this country...
Suggesting that there needs to be a scientific answer for something, saying rather than suggesting there was a problem with it.
With the implied implication that there's something wrong with being gay, which is clearly what she believes, that it's a sin and it's wrong, and that somehow you can be scientifically cured, you can be converted back.
Well, she didn't quite say that, but look, the point is this: there are millions of people out there who are practicing Roman Catholics in this country.
I am. I'm a Roman Catholic. I don't agree with bigotry against gay people.
So now Piers Morgan has struck back and attempted to seize the moral high ground by not only saying that he is a Roman Catholic, but also by going straight in there and accusing the Brexit Party and Anne Widdecombe of bigotry. There, he said it, he's made the accusation, and now he feels he's got the upper hand. Let's see what happens.
People, in a free society, tolerance needs to be a two-way street. And I do think, I really do think, that devout Christians should be allowed to have their opinion.
So, boom, the perfect comeback. Immediately says people are entitled to their opinions. Absolutely perfect response.
Have their opinions, Nigel, but should they be allowed to say something as inflammatory as, you're not just wrong, but hopefully science will be able to cure you? Because if I was a gay person, I would find that incredibly insensitive.
Well,
and indeed offensive. Yeah. And I would want you, as the leader of the Brexit Party, to take a pretty firm stand and say, you can have your religious views, but actually I don't believe. I mean, do you personally believe?
So Piers is actively ratcheting this up now. He's starting the Spanish Inquisition. He's saying, look, surely you're going to come out and condemn this. How can you let this comment go? You're the leader. You need to come out and say this is wrong. This is wrong. You need to condemn it. Kind of interesting.
Engage conversion therapy.
Piers, I will take no stand on this whatsoever.
Really?
I certainly won't. No, I believe in issues of conscience. I believe it very strongly.
But what is your belief about homosexuality?
So now, after having failed to extract the condemnation that he was looking for from the leader of the party, Piers moves on to a second tack, which is trying to draw Nigel Farage's own personal views on this matter out. So he's looking for a second route to a condemnation. Let's see what happens.
Do you believe that people can be cured of homosexuality through science?
I very much doubt human beings can be cured of anything. I think we're born the way we
are. Should they be cured?
And we tend to stay with our characteristics for the whole of our life.
This is a serious thing for gay people in this country. Gay people want to know, is the Brexit Party on their side or not? And your reluctance to say that gay people can't be cured by science.
So note how the identity politics has crept in now. It's not just everybody who wants to know this, it's gay people specifically want to know this, to know if they can vote for the Brexit Party, to know if all of the Brexit Party stands for this idea of curing people of homosexuality. What's interesting here is that Farage is steadfastly refusing to give the answer that Piers wants him to ask. It's kind of an interesting game. Let's carry on.
I haven't commented on it. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put Louis Stedman Bryce, who is gay, who was our MEP for Scotland, and you can have him on your programme tomorrow and ask him how he feels about it.
I'm asking you. You're the leader of the party.
Yes, and I will not support or condemn individuals for their views on abortion, on homosexuality, on issues of conscience. Right,
and boom, he's doubled down yet again on his original answer, which is, as I said, the perfect liberal answer to this question. Watch Piers Morgan now. It's almost like he cannot process the fact that somebody is refusing to play ball on this.
But do you personally believe homosexuality is a sin?
No, I don't.
Okay, so do you think do you personally believe that? I think it's important, Nigel. This.
So do I. That's why I'm saying
you should,
it again.
I don't think you should wriggle off the hook of responsibility as a party leader for one of the biggest issues in this country, which is gay rights, right, and equality. Do you personally believe gay people can be converted back to being heterosexual?
I thought, in terms of gay rights and equality, there was legislation in place. I thought we'd done that work.
Yeah, but
what
is your belief? Do you think people can be cured?
I thought we'd done that. No, Piers, I've said once already, and I'll say it again, I think we're born the way we are, and basically, through our lives, we very rarely change at all.
Right.
Do you think that religious rights should trump gay rights?
I think people should be allowed to have gay rights, and I think people should be allowed to have religious conscience. And goodness me, if we start to attack and condemn people because of religious conscience, we're going to cause all sorts of problems in this country, not just, I might add, with Roman Catholics, but with many, many others of Muslim faith who have even stronger feelings on this subject. Yeah. Than
Achievement unlocked.
So now Nigel Farage has brought Islam into the question. He's brought to the Muslims and the recent process in Birmingham into the question, and all of a sudden he's actually put the leftists and Piers Morgan and the other woman there on the back foot by bringing this in and saying, look, religious freedom is actually pretty important, so you better be tolerant of their views as well as your socially progressive right on ones. Quite extraordinary to see this happening on national television. Let's see what they do.
But here's the problem.
Let's just accept that tolerance is a two-way street.
Yeah, but you see, but it doesn't sound very tolerant. That's my problem with it. And the other problem with it is that when you become an MEP, as Anne Widdecombe just has, and I like Anne Widdecombe personally, but I was alarmed by these comments, is that she's now in a position to help formulate policy on these issues. In Northern Ireland, for example, the abortion debate has been raging now for a very long time. For you to simply say you have no opinion on abortion, I think would alarm people.
I'll tell you what's intolerant. It's when the pack mentality decides that a certain group of people have a view that is not acceptable in their mainstream lives and they should be hounded out of public office for having a different point of view.
Boom, boom, boom. I mean, have you ever seen a politician make this point in such a direct and obvious way on television? This is quite extraordinary, and it's may well be a watershed moment. I mean, this is essentially the point that so many of us in the YouTube community have been making for many years at this point. What's interesting is that he did not campaign on this issue, but by insisting on his neutrality on these moral questions and by being perfect classical liberal, he's drawing out the intolerance of Piers Morgan and his co-host here. quite amazing.
That. Now, I didn't say that.
That is real. Well, you hinted it.
And no,
that
no,
is real,
no, 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 no.
That is real intolerance.
No, because I would agree with you about that. Except, yeah. Well, I would argue that your position as leader in saying I don't want to express an opinion about anything to do with gay rights or abortion.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that. I've expressed an opinion in this interview. What I said was, I will not condemn or support individuals on matters of conscience.
But the Brexit Party, just to clarify, and I'm going to leave it after this, the Brexit Party, to clarify, does not have a position on homosexuality that you can be cured of it.
No, of course not. And nor does it have an official line on abortion or the death penalty or any of those things. They are matters of conscience for individuals. And that's important. Let's have more people in public life who've got their own views on things rather than being told what they should think by mainstream media or their party leaders. Like,
he is absolutely bossing this at this point, and they know it. And you can feel the presenters reeling from these answers because they know deep down that this will be getting through to people at home.
Sexuality is not a matter of conscience, it's a matter of fact.
People's views on it are a matter of conscience, and you know that, and we've seen outside those schools in Birmingham Muslim parents protesting over the course of the last week. There are different points of view out there. We need to understand that.
Well, let's just understand that we just accept people who are gay and not argument about it.
Well, I think that's right. So there we are. I agree.
Of course, she felt the need to reassert the official opinion, the prevailing view at the end there, and Nigel just made it clear that he was ready to go at the end. But I actually think this was a really interesting interview. Tell me what you think in the comments. It will be interesting to see if this episode affects support for the Brexit Party at all. What was really interesting to me about this interview was the power dynamics. Nigel Farage knew that it was a power play. They were trying to force him, they were trying to compel him to either make an apology or to reassert and reaffirm his commitment to gay rights or something like this, and he just refused point blank again and again and again to play their games. I mean, to me, that's a break of the conditioning, it's a break of the linguistic power game, and it's a win for Nigel Farage. Let me know what you think in the comments. I thought it was very interesting, and it could be the start of something new here. This may well be the moment of breaking political correctness in mainstream politics in this country that we've been waiting for. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Stetson F. Lionel, The Ambivalent Onion, Christopher Scholholm, The Crimson Satyr, Chris, Kieran Haywood, Mr. A.M. Swainson, Radical Liberation, The Binary Surfer, Tragic Vision, Bailey and Aurora, Toyotomi Ami, Holy Spatula, Alexander, Froggy, Splice, Buck Egypt Society, Michael Meir, Jay Greenriver, Michael Tynan, Heronius Napalm V, Vincenzo Rapio, and Edward Darrow.
According to Owen Jones, LGBTQ people are under attack. Pride is not just some party. It is a defiant protest for our rights. There are such signs in the annual parade as "We're here, we're queer, we're full of existential fear." In this video, I'd like to give a shout out to all of those brave people today who got out there and really stuck it to the establishment. 10 Downing Street supports Pride. Theresa May supports Pride. Boris Johnson supports Pride. The Labour Party supports Pride. The Liberal Democrats support Pride. The Foreign Office supports Pride. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, supports Pride. The Metropolitan Police support Pride. Transport for London supports Pride. The NHS supports Pride. The London Ambulance Service supports Pride. The St. John's Ambulance supports Pride. Arsenal Football Club supports Pride. Tottenham Hotspur support Pride. Chelsea Football Club support Pride. The Boy Scouts support Pride. The British Academy supports Pride. The Royal Opera House supports Pride. The Royal Academy of Engineering supports Pride. The Royal Society of Biology supports Pride. The Natural History Museum supports Pride. Barclaycard support Pride. Lloyds Bank support Pride. ITV supports Pride. McDonald's support Pride. Costa Coffee supports Pride. All of the advertisers at Piccadilly Circus support Pride. Just Eat support Pride. London Zoo supports Pride. Fuller's Pubs support Pride. Even the traffic lights support Pride. Even Muslims support Pride. Dare to be different. Dare to take a stand. Dare to be defiant. Support Pride. In this video, I seek to challenge the prevailing wisdom that conservative reactionary revolutions in history have come about because of economic concerns. The mainstream view, chiefly derived from a materialist Marxist analysis, says that the rise of fascism in Europe was caused by economic depression, that it was the desperate cry of the left behind, or that it was capitalism's last defense against communism, and that people have largely been tricked by demagogues. This is largely not true. Most fascists in both Italy and Germany were not people on the breadline or dolts, but ordinary men and women, mostly from the middle and lower middle classes, especially from the countryside. 75% of Mussolini's support was from the middle and the lower middle classes, while only 15% were from the working class. Hitler drew support from small and large landowners, mostly from rural areas. Mainstream conservatives and churches supported him. Instead, my view is that the chief causes of radical right-wing movements have been mostly cultural. People who have joined these movements saw themselves as vanguards organizing a moral civilizational defense against perceived decay and collapse. I also believe that these were genuinely felt emotions and not some product of propaganda. Leaders like Mussolini and Hitler tapped into already existing sentiments. They did not produce them. I mention this, of course, because there are many obvious parallels between the historical moment of the 1920s and 1930s and today, where a new right has risen across Europe, in Brazil, and of course in America with Donald Trump. Here in Britain, I think Brexit masks a similar lurking cultural backlash. In almost all of these cases, the root cause is what I would call social liberalism, especially the subversion of the arts and a loosening of traditional moral norms and doctrines of so-called sexual liberation. I also see similarities with what happened in the Iranian Revolution in 1979, which was at root a conservative cultural backlash against imported Western social liberalism. The real cause is not only an underlying sense of moral revulsion, but something much more profound, a profound sense of loss of identity and a yearning for the ruling class to somehow put back together the old historical identity in a new and self-affirming form. Interestingly, it seems that the Canadian elites have realized this in a story that emerged yesterday. Justin Trudeau's administration has been advised to, quote, bring the focus back to the majority in public communications to guard against a rise in populist extremism. People in the majority increasingly feel like their concerns do not matter. It is interesting that if one looks for explanations for the rise of fascism before the end of World War II, one finds quite a lot of support from my view, even drawn from opponents of fascism. For example, Giuseppe Antonio Borghese in 1932 had this to say: if we want a more complete and truthful insight into human events, the intellectual and emotional elements of those events need to be taken more largely into account. They are not always economic interests in disguise, but much more often, on the contrary, the economic interests are embodiments and materializations of intellectual judgments or prejudices and of emotional drives. The famous sociologist Talcott Parsons also rejected the economic explanation. He said, the cultural development of the period has been predominantly one to undermine simplicity and stability of orientation. It has been an extraordinary extent, a
period of the debunking of traditional values and ideas, and one in which, for previously stable cultural patterns in such fields as religion, ethics, and philosophy, no comparably stable substitutes have appeared, rather a conspicuously unstable factionalism and tendency to fadistic fluctuation. Part of the situation is an inevitable consequence of the enormous development of popular education and of the development of mass means of communication, so the cultural influences, which in an earlier time reached only a relatively small, sophisticated minority, now impinge upon a very large proportion of the total population. And then, later, Parsons says, fascism has seemed to stand in the logic of the sentiments for sound traditional values and to constitute a bulwark against subversive radicalism. Finally, Peter Drucker said, the fundamental explanation is one that few of us have had the courage to grasp. If you would understand that Hitler and Mussolini have made of freedom a shivering refugee on the Atlantic coast, you must realize that, one after the other, each group of the Europeans had lost effective belief in its creed. Now, in order to demonstrate my case, I cannot really provide statistics, facts, or figures, because this is ultimately something that cannot be measured. The general mood of a people, because of the pervasiveness of certain ideas and tendencies in the culture, isn't something that can really be quantified. So rather than try to convince you intellectually of this, I need to make you, in some sense, feel it. And so I have put together a short montage set to some music. Let me know what you think. Oh, and if you do happen to make it to the end, remember to get out.
On Plymouth Rock, if today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was a look dawned to something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. Good offers too. Who once knew better words, now only use four letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if bare limbs you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the set that smart is intruding and nudist parties in studio. Anything goes. When Mrs. Ned McLean, God bless her, can get Russian red to yes, then I suppose anything goes.
Berlin in the 1920s was the sex capital of Europe. Its very name became synonymous with perversion, debauchery, and creativity.
Places that you hadn't noticed would turn into outrageous strip clubs. The basements of the restaurants would be homosexual or lesbian romper rooms and sex clubs.
Every intellectual was leftish. The whole political right wing, which basically came from Munich, did not play any role in the beginning. The whole town was in the hands of leftish ideas.
It was a city that was filled with lesbian life. There was the idea that everywhere you went, you didn't have to hide what you were. Drugs were readily available in Berlin. Every variety of drug, morphine, cocaine, opium. The morphine and the cocaine you could probably get prescribed by your local doctor or pharmacist. Opium was widely available, and also drugs were used in sexual science. Sexual scientists were very interested in the effects of, for instance, morphine would have on the orgasmic rate of a lesbian. So there was a complete scientific culture.
Berlin had become the center of sexual experimentation. It also became the center of scientific research into sex, led by a pioneering doctor.
And this was a very funny character called Papa, or the Einstein of sex in Berlin. It was Magnus Hirschfeld. Hirschfeld was a queer, Jewish, social democrat who really defined the liberal spirit of Berlin.
Unlike his fellow doctor in Vienna, Sigmund Freud, Hirschfeld advocated the radical notion that human sexuality could be studied without imposing moral judgments.
Hirschfeld's also credited with operations and surgeries of sex change and sexual rejuvenation. He had a clinic for people to be consulted about sexual problems.
When Rockefeller still can hoard enough money to let Matt Gordon produce his show, anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, and that gent today, you gave a cent today, once had several chateaus. When folks who still can ride in jitneys find out Vanderbilts and Whitneys lack baby clothes, anything goes. When Sam Goldwyn can with great conviction instruct Anna, send in diction, then Anna shows, anything goes. When you hear that Lady Mendel standing up, now does a handspring landing up on her toes, anything goes. Just think of those shocks you got, and those knocks you got, and those blues you got from those news you got, and those pains you got, if any brains you got from those little radios. So Mrs. R, with all her trimmings, can broadcast a bed from Simmons, cause Franklin knows anything goes.
About a month ago, I started planning a video of British birth rates and some of the possible causes of its decline. After gathering an absolute pile of data, it turned out not to be that interesting, if I'm honest. But I did stumble on something that was quite interesting, at least to me. That is the gap between heterosexual STDs and, as they put it in the literature, men who have sex with men. I've linked the raw data in the notes, but let me just pull up some interesting stats that I found. First, what is the percentage of LGBT people in the UK? In 2017, the Office of National Statistics estimated it from a very robust survey at about 2%. The infamous Kinsey report, written in 1948, estimated that it is more like 10% of people. In 2005, pushing through Tony Blair's Civil Partnerships Act, the UK Treasury estimated that it was 6%. Now, people can argue about these numbers, and the data that I've seen suggests that the 2%, or even fewer than that, is likely more accurate. But for the purposes of this video, let us say that the real figure is 5%. Okay, so with this established figure of 5%, what about these STDs? For chlamydia, men who have sex with men account for 29% of all cases involving men, whereas women who have sex with women account for just 0.31% of all cases involving women. 9% of cases were black people, who make up 3% of the population. So as an ethnic group, they over-index here, whereas Asians, who make up 8% of the total population, account for just 2.25% of cases of chlamydia. 27% of all cases involve people of unknown ethnicity. Let's have a look at gonorrhea now. Men who have sex with men, 67% of cases involving men, 67%. Women who have sex with women, only 0.6% of cases involving women. 67% of cases involve white people, versus 86% of the total population. 12% of cases involve black people versus 3% of the population. 3.6% of cases involved Asian people versus 8% of the population. and 7% was unknown. For syphilis, a fairly staggering 87% of all cases involving men are men who have sex with men. Cases among women are very low. For example, in 2018, over 5,000 men who have sex with men had syphilis, whereas total cases of women, period, numbered less than 500, of whom just 7 were women who have sex with women. In terms of ethnicity stats, 74% of cases involve white people, 5.7% of cases black people, 4.6% Asian people, and 4% unknown. Now, looking through all of these numbers, I think that it is striking that men who have sex with men, even if they account for 5% or even 10% of all men, significantly over-index, and women who have sex with women significantly under-index across the board. One of the things I find interesting about this is that historically, different cultures had specifically banned the act of sodomy, whereas, for example, here in Britain, to my knowledge, lesbianism was never outlawed at all. It was specifically sodomy that was banned, at least until the Indecency Act of the late 19th century. In times before modern medicine or antibiotics, which can treat some of these STDs, one can see why there might have been social rules and morals built around sexuality. This is a picture of someone with syphilis in 1496. Left untreated, it can deform you to the point where your nose falls off. And I think this is the chief reason why there has always been some form of moral revulsion around what people call debauchery, from Sodom and Gomorrah onwards. Scenes of hedonism and pleasure like this, the seedier side of life if you will, feel edgier, perhaps a little unsafe, because there is some risk involved. And I surmise that the root cause of this are in the statistics I've talked you through today. From a period where there were no treatments, where medicine wasn't going to sort you out if you got any of these conditions. Whatever the reasons, the link between debauchery and sin seems quite deeply cast in our myths, legends, and religious texts. This was a stray thought. Now get out. Now, I had a whole different script written out for this video, but I decided not to bother you with it for reasons I will keep to myself. Instead, I wanted to pose quite a different question. That is, what sort of world does the Britisher want? He wants seemingly all things to be permissible and for there to be no moral standards of any sort. My view is that there should be moral and social norms. By this, I don't mean a law banning anything. I just mean a normative social attitude that establishes a set of desirable behaviours. Let's say humility, kindness, patience, diligence, temperance, abstinence, and chastity, and which discourages another set of behaviours, less desirable ones. Let's say pride, envy, wrath, sloth, avarice, gluttony, and greed. Now, both of these things are part of human nature. The ones on the left come very easily to us. It's the path of least resistance. We can give in to them. The ones on the right are much harder to strive for and require some sort of self-control in most, if not all, cases. So, it's a case of the path of least resistance on the left and the more difficult path on the right. Now, of course, since humans are human, they will very often fail to follow the more difficult path and will lapse. I think that at least holding up the ideal of the virtues as something to strive for helps us reach something closer to an equilibrium between libertinage and Puritanism. I postulate that the more we give in to the sins as a whole, to the point where the virtues themselves are a distant memory, the more degenerate society becomes. And this degenerate society seems to be the world that Britisher wants, some weird wasteland where we are permanently trapped in the cultural zeitgeist of 1998. But what happens to such a society? Does it make those who inhabit it happier? What do we see when there are no moral norms, no common standards of decency, no expectation of restraint or moral responsibility incumbent on any individual at all? Well, let's take a look.
All right, my comment is for the little midget with the basement tattoos. Why did you go from Snow White over here to Sideshow Bob? Like, what?
Travis, I'd like to ask you, how could you diss your baby mama for DMX and the Sidekick?
For the girl in the orange on the side, why are you wasting your time with this wannabe 2 Chainz when you can, like, you're such a, you'd be an awesome single mom. Right. Go find yourself a good man, not this noodle head.
I have a question for the cowboy, like, dudes. How'd it feel to have sex with Michael Jackson?
A few, like 2 comments. It's for Johnny Cash on Helium over here. Why would you leave? She's beautiful. She's a BBW. Beautiful, big woman. She's take big however you want to for Jack Skeleton in a wig. And the other one is for Miss Beauty in the back. Miss Beauty in the back.
You need a wig.
You don't need Mr. Predator versus Alien versus Predator over here. 10 years is not enough for the way he
That's
disrespected you in front of everybody.
That's
you don't need it.
This is for the shirt. If you like having sex with women with penis, why don't you just buy your white?
We just want our Jerry B.
Here is a graph showing the nations of the world by suicide rate per 100,000 people. The world average is 8.91. As you can see, Russia has the world's biggest suicide rate at 31, and Morocco is among the lowest with 2.9. Now, as you study this graph, it should strike you that the populations of the most rich and powerful nations seem to be near the top, while those at the bottom, with the exception of Saudi Arabia, are from poorer nations. For example, the suicide rate of the USA is 5.3 times higher than Pakistan's. France's is 5.2 times higher than Indonesia's. South Korea's is 6.6 times higher than Iran's. China's is 3.3 times higher than Morocco's, and the UK's is 4.7 times higher than Syria's, despite Syria being a war-torn nation in recent years. Why is this? In Ride the Tiger, written in 1961, Julius Evola spotted this trend even 60 years ago, and he gave some suggestions as to why this might be the case. I'm going to read out 2 key pages from this book, and then I'm going to see to what extent we can qualify the claims that he makes using data. He says, "But to avoid straying too far from my argument, the point is that the most acute forms of the modern existential crisis are appearing today at the margin of a civilization of prosperity, as witness the currents in the new generation that have been described. One sees their rebellion, disgust and anger manifesting not in a wretched and oppressed sub-proletariat, but often in young people who lack nothing, even in millionaires' children. And among other things, it is a significant fact statistically proven that suicide is much rarer in poor countries than in rich ones, showing that the problematic life is felt more in the latter than in the former. Blank despair can occur right up to the finishing post of socioeconomic messianism, as in the musical comedy about a utopian island where they have everything, fun, women and whiskey, but also the ever recurrent sense of the emptiness of existence, the sense that something is still missing. There exists, therefore, no correlation, except possibly a negative one, between the meaning of life and conditions of economic well-being. There is a famous example, not recent, but from the traditional world, of the Buddha Shakyamuni. He who, on a metaphysical plane, radically denounced the emptiness of existence and the deceptions of the God of life, pointing out the way of spiritual awakening, was not a victim of oppression and hunger, not a representative of social strata like the plebeians of the Roman Empire to whom the revolutionary sermons of Christianity were first addressed. No, he was of the race of princes in all the splendor of his power and all the fullness of his youth. The true significance of the socio-economic myth in any of its forms is as a means of internal anaestheticization or prophylaxis aimed at evading the problem of an existence robbed of any meaning and at consolidating in every way the fundamental insignificance of modern man's life. We may therefore speak either of an opiate that is much more real than that which, according to the Marxists, was fed to a humanity as yet unillumined and unevolved, mystified by religious beliefs, or, from another point of view, of the organized method of an active nihilism. The prospects in goodly part of today's world are more or less those that Zarathustra attributed to the last man. This is Zarathustra. The time is near of the most despicable of men who can no longer despise himself. The last man of the tenacious and pullulitating race. We have invented happiness, say the last men with a wink, having abandoned the lands where life is hard. In this context, there is another more recent phenomenon that is heavy with significance, that of the so-called global protest movement. It took its rise in part from the order of ideas already mentioned. In the wake of theories such as Marcuse's, it came to the conclusion that there is a basic similarity in terms of technological consumer society between the system of advanced communist countries and that of the capitalist world, because in the former, the original impulse of the proletarian revolution is much diminished. This impulse has now been realized, inasmuch as the working class has entered the consumer system, being assured of a lifestyle that is no longer proletarian but bourgeois, the very thing whose absence was the incentive for revolution. But alongside this convergence, there has become visible the conditioning power of one and the same system, manifesting as the tendency to destroy all the higher values of life and personality at the level more or less corresponding to the last man foreseen by Nietzsche. The individual in contemporary consumer society reckons that it would be too expensive, indeed absurd, to do without the comfort and well-being that this evolved society offers him, merely for the sake of an abstract freedom. Thus, he accepts with a good grace all the leveling conditionings of the system. This realization has caused a bypassing of revolutionary Marxism, now deprived of its original motive force, in favor of a global protest against the system. This movement, however, also lacks any higher principle. It is irrational, anarchic, and instinctive in character. For want of anything else, it calls on the abject minorities of outsiders, on the excluded and rejected, sometimes even on the third world, in which case Marxist fantasies reappear, and on the black people as being the only ones with revolutionary potential. But it stands under the sign of nothingness. It is a hysterical revolution of the void and the underground, of maddened wasps trapped in a glass jar who throw themselves frantically against the walls. What a stunning passage that is, with much to dwell on, and even more remarkable that it was written 60 years ago rather than yesterday. How accurate is that a description of many of the upheavals that we've seen in the past few years? Now, the trouble with trying to quantify things like materialism and traditionalism, which would be the metrics that Evola would wish to use, is that we have to rely on surveys. Such surveys tell us that China is the most materialistic nation and that Sweden is the least. But Evola would have totally scoffed at the idea that Sweden was not a materialistic nation, because he was talking about an entire mode of utilitarian thinking and being, which foregrounds only base concerns like food, comfort, and shelter, rather than what he would call matters of a higher purpose, such as transcendent ideals. But even putting Evola aside, the idea that the UK in the year 2021 is only, quote, 16% materialistic is totally laughable, even on its face. I mean, it's the nation that gave us this. What a survey like this proves is only that people in countries like the UK and Sweden have some idea that they should not be materialistic, enough at least to give pollsters like this the quote-unquote right answer. Not that these countries are any less materialistic than any of the others shown on this graph. Similarly, when a polling firm like Ipsos Mori tries to measure traditionalism, it finds ridiculous results suggesting that the UK is one of the most traditional countries in the world. Again, a survey like this finds only what people aspire to be, not what they actually are. The notion that the UK in the 21st century is in any way a traditional nation is completely laughable and would leave an actual traditionalist, such as Evola, rolling in his grave. So what might be a substitute metric for traditionalism? The closest thing I could find was what people call religiosity. Now, this too is found by a survey simply asking people how important religion is in their lives. But I think there's a good reason to take this one more seriously than those trying to measure either materialism or traditionalism. And that is because I would expect overt atheists to be quite proud of their non-religiosity. And so I have plotted the religiosity of the top 20 most religious and the top or the bottom 20 least religious nations, and then put a dozen or so middling nations in the middle. For example, Italy, which is a fairly religious country with a score of 74%, but is not in the top 20. So I've put that in the middle. And then I have plotted all of these countries against the suicide rate. I also expressed the suicide rate out of 100, treating Russia as 100 for ease of visualization. And that gives us a graph like this. The blue line is religiosity, the red line is suicide. And you can see that these are inversely correlated. That means blue line goes up, red line goes down. Blue line goes down, red line goes up. Look for the diamonds in this graph. So that's where a high red line forms a diamond with a low blue line. And you can see these diamonds forming around Russia, Japan, Hungary, Australia, Austria, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Sweden, Switzerland. All of these form diamonds like this. Now, another way of showing this information is with a scatter graph showing a correlation line like this. Here, the further left a nation, the less religious they are. The further right a nation, the more religious. Now, looking at this, we can see a very clear trend that bears out much of what Evola was saying. Note that Ireland is about dead centre. It has a religiosity of 50%, which would make its kind of Catholic forefathers sad, but still it's higher than the average in Europe. So it's not a surprise to see Ireland dead centre here. It's also not surprising, therefore, to see Italy, which we'd already talked about, and Greece, two nations with serious economic woes, but relatively high religiosity, at least compared to the rest of Europe, well below the average in suicide rate compared with the rest of Europe. Also, we should note some outliers. Now, Russia, we've already said, has got the highest in the world. Belarus is quite high. Hungary and Poland all seem quite far above the line, if you have a look. And very obviously, what connects these is that they are all former communist nations in Eastern Europe. So it seems to me that there's probably some additional factor at play in those places. Perhaps a spell of communism is extra specially demoralizing to a nation. Who knows? But it is notable that the relatively high religiosity of Poland, I believe Poland has the highest in Europe, cannot offset the effects of whatever it is that communism does. Another outlier is China, which despite one, being a communist nation, two, having the lowest religiosity rating in the world, and three, ranking the highest on that materialism survey that we saw, it has a relatively low suicide rate. Now, we might only speculate as to why this is. Perhaps China has greater social cohesion and a higher sense of nationalism than the countries in the West. Or perhaps Chinese communism functions as a kind of surrogate religion. Who knows? But whatever the case, there are many fewer suicides in China than in nearby Japan. One thing that you might point to is the fact that although China has the second highest GDP rate in the world, many people in China are still pretty poor. They're still relatively poor. So the Evola thesis would still hold up when you consider that, you know, there are still many millions of people who are effectively living like medieval peasants in China. Israel too stands out, a relatively low religiosity, but also fewer suicides than elsewhere. And again, much more nationalistic and ethnocentric than any of those nations in Western Europe. So in the case of Israel, perhaps nationalism and ethnocentrism can offset the effects of a lack of religiosity, but clearly not enough to offset what is happening in Poland, Hungary, or Russia. And I'll leave it there. If you have any theories as to what might account for the suicide rates, please leave a comment in the show notes.
If you like Academic Agent's content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.
Buy Foundations of Writing on the Academic Agency. To write clearly will help you to think clearly. The ability to communicate ideas in lucid prose is foundational to success in many areas, and it is a basic requirement in every walk of life. You will learn the parts of speech and come to understand the core functions of the English language, sentence construction and syntax, punctuation, style, and common mistakes. Once you see how mistakes are made, you will not unsee them. You will know for the rest of your life. Foundations of Writing. Buy it now.
I came across a thread on Twitter today. Here's how it started. Enough politics. Abs time. This post had almost 60,000 likes and over 800 replies. Now we're going to come back to those replies in a moment. I don't care about who this person is. Before I even start, I want to head off four degenerate copes that I just know some dweeb in the chat or the comments will be trying to make. Let me save you the trouble and list them. Number one, what's wrong with abs? Do you want girls to be fat? Number two, you're just a boomer who doesn't get the tomboy abs fetish subculture, bro. Number three, if you're against this, it's obviously some insecurity on your part. Number four, stop getting triggered and acting like a prude, bro. They're just being ironic and exaggerating, trying to wind you up. Well, listen.
Fuck all that.
So just stop, okay? Enough with these justifications and copes. Don't want to hear them. I don't care. I've heard it all before anyway, when I focused on the femboy issue and the anime to porn to trans pipeline last year. Now many fewer people doubt what I was saying back then. And so it shall be with so-called tomboy abs and this absurd trend that we're seeing. Both of these things, the femboy and the tomboy, point to a deeper existential malaise in a culture that has seriously lost its way. And before you libertarians start, it's not fucking kink, okay? It's not a private matter. It's not a case of what goes on in the bedroom. So please shut up for a second while the natural law is laid down. This is a civilizational matter because we are a civilization under both tremendous attack and in steep decline. Therefore, it matters that our young women are trying to behave like men in this way, and it matters even more that our young men are responding in public and under their real names, mind you, like this.
I think that we've reached peak wank.
Now, because people are stupid, I can't just let this picture speak for itself. I'm going to have to really spell it out so that even Billy at the back of the class can get it. The woman is built like a man. The man is a little snake wimp on his knees in the classic blowjob position. And to cap it all off, she's holding his head. There's even a variant where she calls him little boy. This isn't some one-off response. This is a cultural phenomenon big enough to be a meme. But it should be clear that the tomboy abs is a gateway to fantasies of complete gender reversal. This young man wants to put himself in the position of a teenage girl serving a bigger and more masculine man. He is abdicating his responsibility as a man and asking the woman to be the man in his place. In other words, he is verbalizing his desire to be feminine, to become a woman. Now, because it's 2021 and people are extra specially stupid in this day and age, I'm going to get another reply to ensure that you really get it. I'm going to bash you over the head. Remember I mentioned Conan and his sledgehammer? This video is me wielding Conan's sledgehammer, okay? So let's look at this one. Here, Nikki responds to the picture of the masculine woman with a degenerate anime meme of what appears to be a schoolgirl squirting milk from their genitals. Now Nikki imagines himself as a schoolgirl with a penis exploding at the sight of a strong woman. If you look at the written text, it is also written in a particularly girlish way. I'm so horny right now. Let's do some more for luck. Here's a Japanese-looking girl, posted as the point of view character from the male Twitter user licking the tomboy abs. This is the complete inversion of Laura Mulvey's male gaze. This is the female gaze internalized by young men. Here's another variant. Here, the man imagines himself as a young anime girl with a fucking ponytail poking their tongue out trying to lick the toned stomach of a muscular woman. This is why the terrorists hate us. Now, while I don't want to see a single comment defending this shit, and I will delete them if I see them, I cannot blame the young men and the young women who are the victims of this. Yes, it is true that male and female traits are biologically rooted, but there is some slack there which culture picks up, and whatever slack is there, our culture is pushing to breaking point, inducing problems of internal identity on young and impressionable men and women who live dazed and confused by all of this, addicted to porn and this sort of gender-bending nonsense on a daily basis. I'm led to believe that the likes of Count Dankula and others have tried to normalise and defend all of this. This isn't something that should be defended. It's ultimately terminal for civilizational prospects. It is quite literally training men to think of themselves as women, to ape the behaviours of women. And when the barbarian does invade, can we be sure that these men will shake it all off and fight, or will they drop to their knees with their tongue hanging out? This tomboy rubbish is just the tip of a much deeper iceberg that infiltrates Zuma culture at every level, especially in porn, but also in all of the other degenerate forms, you know, the forums, the anime, the 4chan, all of the gamer spaces, and so on and so forth. This sort of thing is just the everyday life. Another cope that somebody gave me is, oh, don't react to something on Twitter. Let me tell you something. Twitter is real life. It's more real, and it affects real life more than anybody expects. How can anybody have lived through the past 3 or 4 years and not think that Twitter is real life? Of course it is. This is what young men are spending their time doing. Don't give me that. Cope. Now, it's hard to blame anyone, particularly on an individual level, because the cultural messaging they've been getting since the 1990s has trended in this direction to greater or lesser extremes. Let me read some of the lyrics of a song that I grew up with, Girls and Boys by Blur. Love. Now, what is the traditional answer to all of this? Let's see what Julius Evola says in Revolt Against the Modern World.
We know that every traditional civilization is based on the will to order and give form, and that the traditional law is not oriented toward what is unqualified, equal, and indefinite, or in other words, toward that impersonal mix in which the various parts of the whole become promiscuously or atomically similar, but rather intends these parts to be themselves and to express as perfectly as possible their own typical nature. Therefore, particularly with regard to the genders, man and woman are two different types. Those who are born as men must realize themselves as men, while those who are born as women must realize themselves as women, overcoming any mixture and promiscuity of vocations. Even in regard to the supernatural vocation, man and woman must both have their own distinctive paths to follow, which cannot be altered without them turning into contradictory and inorganic ways of being.
Already, Evola rules out the prospect of the manly woman or the girly man as contradictory and inorganic. Self-actualization in the traditional concept is about realizing yourself as your own gender. Men must realize themselves as men, and women must realize themselves as women. Now, what does that mean exactly? Evola continues.
I've already considered the way of being that corresponds eminently to man. I've also discussed the two main paths of approach to the value of being a principle to oneself, namely, action and contemplation. Thus, the warrior, the hero, and the ascetic represent the two fundamental types of pure virility. In symmetry with these types, there are also two types available to the feminine nature. A woman realizes herself as such and even rises to the same level reached by a man as warrior and ascetic only as lover and mother. These are bipartitions of the same ideal strain. Just as there is an active heroism, there is also a passive heroism. There is a heroism of absolute affirmation and a heroism of absolute dedication. They can both be luminous and produce plenty of fruits, as far as overcoming human limitations and achieving liberation are concerned, when they are lived with purity and in the sense of an offering. This differentiation of the heroic strain determines the distinctive character of the paths of fulfillment available to men and women. In the case of women, the actions of the warrior and of the ascetic who affirm themselves in a life that is beyond life, the former through pure action and the latter through pure detachment, correspond to the act of the woman totally giving of herself and being entirely for another being, whether he is the loved one, the type of the lover, the aphrodisiac woman, or the son, the type of the mother, the Demetrian woman, finding in this dedication the meaning of her own life, her own joy, and her own justification. This is what bhakti or fides, which constitute the normal and natural way of participation of the traditional woman, really mean, both in the order of form and even beyond form, when it is lived in a radical and impersonal way. To realize oneself in an increasingly resolute way according to these two distinct and unmistakable directions, to reduce in a woman all that is masculine and in a man everything that is feminine, and to strive to implement the archetypes of the absolute man and of the absolute woman. This was the traditional law concerning the sexes according to their different planes of existence.
Evelus suggests that men and women won't ever truly find themselves, so to speak, unless they adopt either the path of absolute affirmation, that's being a warrior, a man of action, as a man, or a lover, that is giving herself over entirely to a man, as a woman. And the other path is the path of absolute dedication, that's being an ascetic, essentially one who transcends and overcomes sensual pleasures as a man, or a mother that is giving herself entirely to the child as a woman. The hardest aspect for the liberal mind to understand in all of this is that those paths represent ultimate freedom in self-actualization for any of us. And everything else, all of the other temptations in life, which modernity throws our way and sells to us as freedom, is a trap. Now, when I say the liberal mind, I don't just mean Democrat voters and communists or something like that. I mean me, you, all of us. Me, you, and everyone watching this constantly defaults to thinking in a liberal way, because these are the waters in which we swim. This is how we've all been socialized from the second that we were born. We default to thinking of Evola's traditional edict here as being overly austere and constrictive in its prescriptions, and therefore we immediately try to find exceptions or counters or way to justify having a more enlightened or modern view of the matter. Now, Jonathan Bowden once commented on this tendency to try to find the liberal cope. Let's just listen to him for a moment.
I think the point to make about vanguardism is whenever anything happens, people in other groups and people in other vanguards and liberal humanists in our own group, because the previous speaker said quite truthfully that it is indigenous liberals who are our real enemy. Indigenous liberals are always the enemy. Liberalism within ourselves is always the enemy. It exists even in people who regard themselves as radical to a certain extent. We've had liberalism in an uninterrupted way for centuries. Russia's never known a liberal regime. And whether one likes it or not, the politics of contemporary Russia have a lot to do with the fact that they've never known a period of liberalism. You could argue that since the restoration of the monarchy in the 1600s, we've known nothing but various forms of liberalism, most of which linked to various elements of the Protestant religion during that time. But until about the 1950s or 60s, most forms of Protestantism retained residual, illiberal, and patriotic ideas, as for a period they did in a very sectarian way in Northern Ireland. So all views have their liberal side. Even our liners have their liberal side, which they have to guard against, and guard against chipping away at them. Liberalism also feeds on indifference, and indifference to the future, and indifference to the generations that are coming in the future.
Did you hear that?
liberalism within ourselves is always the enemy. Liberalism also feeds on indifference, indifference to the future and indifference to the generations that are coming in the future. And this is what I notice most when I scratch on these little issues of degeneracy in the culture now and again, like I'm doing in this video. There's always a contingent in the audience who'd rather I didn't look, who'd rather I didn't care. Why do you care about this academic agent, they'll say? Why do you care if some silly Zoomers want to lick the abs of masculine women? I care because I care about future generations. I care because I care about this current generation. This is not a healthy place for our people to be in. And you should care. And when you try to fob me off and get me not to care, whether you know it or not, you're working for the interests of the enemy. Because, you know, the enemy want this to happen. A people is more pliable, easier to manipulate, if you have a generation of confused, girlish men and a generation of even more confused, mannish women, constantly locked in a battle against their true natures. It is satanic. And when you cope and try to ward off and explain away this shit against the vanguard of the right, you're doing the bidding of the regime. You're acting as an apologist for their inversion of tradition. You're acting as Satan's little helper. And this shit right here corrodes the soul. Now, I saw one of the best lines I'd seen for a while in my Telegram group earlier from Ananon. And this, thinking like this, is how you must crush libertine and libertarian pushback on all these moral sorts of questions. He said, "We hate the left because they enforce an evil morality, not because they enforce morality." Yes, 1,000 times yes, Anon, correct. And morality must be enforced because, as you may see eventually from my speech at the recent event, if it's ever uploaded, culture is downstream from law. And this culture is downstream from a law which categorically cannot distinguish between men and women at a legal level. A law which actually punishes attempts to conform to or to enforce traditional views on genders such as Evola's. It's not a private matter. It's not something that's just up to individuals and all that other shit that you're going to give me. It's my business and it's yours if you care about your civilization. And just before I made this video, some little dipshit on Twitter wrote this. He said, "What's wrong with womanly abs? This is how conservatives lose the younger generation. You are the Puritan of our time." Well, let me just tell you this. If I was in charge, the regime would force you to stop being such a... I am aware that Susan is listening. But if you are a young man watching this, who wants your girlfriend to be a man and who wants to act like a teenage girl in the safety of her bulging biceps, you don't belong on the right. The correct place for you is to be marching with Antifa against the natural order of things. Get out of here.
Now available at the Academic Agency. Sharpen your analytical mind and your argumentation skills with Foundations of Logic. The course draws on the ancient wisdom of traditional logic that students learned for over 2,000 years, from the time of Aristotle through to the medieval schoolmen, right down to the 20th century. Sign up now for a free preview lecture.
Be sure to like this video and subscribe, and if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.